I'll give as much of my background as you want me to, but
Greetings, Parish Orphans and Retrogrades. Timothy Gordon here. Today, I have continuing row coverage for you. And today's show is a little bit special because it's one of those reproductive issues that even many good Catholics don't fully understand. Today, I have for you Dr. Damon Cudahy, OBGYN, to talk about what I call the sum of all reproductive heresies, IVF. Dr. Damon, thanks for joining the show today.
Thanks for having me, Tim. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you. We've spoken some on the phone. And, you know, Roe versus Wade is, God willing, about to be overturned in June, all indications are. And so everyone's talking about Roe. Everyone's talking about the forced defederalization of abortion. It was once a state's issue. Now it became a federal issue. Now it's becoming a defederalized issue. And we're talking about in Catholic circles, because all of us really as Catholics led the charge on this issue, all of those surrounding auxiliary indicia and implications of defederalizing abortion. Well, what never gets spoken about, Dr. Damon, is IVF. And you really impressed me with I don't want to call it a talking point, but a kind of synopsis on IVF as the synthesis of all of the reproductive sins rolled into one. If anything, it's not less, it's more than all of them, because it's a combination of all these sins. You want to just lead off by telling us what you meant by that?
Sure. So, IVF, it's like, contraception, only it's like the evil twin. With contraception, we're trying to have marital intercourse without the potential for life. And with IVF, we're trying to have life without the physical union of a husband and wife, or even a man and woman at all. So it's almost like the opposite extreme in how we deal with our bodies and reproduction. And so that's the foundational issue. But I think the Catholics in particular, who should be most knowledgeable about it, are not. There's a desperate need for catechesis in this matter, because in my personal experience, having been in an OBGYN training program that had a big IVF component to it, I saw firsthand a lot of the horror of what really happens in a typical IVF clinic and a typical IVF process. So, it's hard to overstate how bad this is. And I can sum it up by one of my mentors. A lot of your listeners will be familiar with a doctor named Dr. Thomas Hilgers. He's the founder of the NAPRO technology, the Creighton model. The Pope Paul VI Institute has done groundbreaking work and trying to find, authentic means of treating problems with infertility. And he summed it up quite simply, and I'll start with this, as that IVF is killing children to make children. And, but that's not all it is, but that, there are many more children that die both willfully, intentionally, and knowingly, during the process. And so it's one of these things that the more, we start looking at the reality of a human being's existence beginning at fertilization, which is synonymous with conception, we can talk a little bit about that. We can start to see what happens, but I have, a list that I've made of, I think it's probably a short list. I used to have 10 points. It's up to about 20 points now. I can start going through them, if you'd like.
Yeah, just for starters. The synthesis of all reproductive sins or heresies. Yeah. You've got, at the very least, adultery, contraception, abortion, cloning, masturbation, pornography, to get, no one thinks of IVF as this evil. Well, you go through your list. Yeah.
So, we can start and, with how are they getting what's called the gametes, or the egg and the sperm? Because very frequently women who go to an IVF clinic are a little bit older, and they may not have what the IVF practitioner considers healthy eggs, or maybe that her husband has a low sperm count. So they're very frequently going to, procure third-party sources for the gametes, for the egg and the sperm. So they start by getting these from typically college-age students, college-age young men and women. So there's already an exploitation of young people as suppliers for the industry. And so you have these parents that have no connection to the child. And this enters into this whole issue of third-party reproduction. And then one of the things that horrified me the first time I saw it was how frequently women are sterilized in the process. And so what may happen is, you know, many times women also have pelvic pain for something, a common condition called endometriosis. So they may do a surgery where they're looking inside for ovarian cyst or tubal disease. And if they see the tubes have some abnormality, like a little bit of fluid collection called a hydrosalpinx, they will very casually and flippantly just remove the tubes, essentially sterilizing the woman. So without talking to her ahead of time, would you like to have, you know, IVF in the future? It's just presumed that anyone would desire this. And so this is not an unusual thing. And they justify it based on being able to improve rates of IVF success if they remove the tubes in many of these situations. So that's another thing that people are horrified to learn, that they're very likely going to be sterilized if an IVF practitioner takes them to the OR. And then they're captured, they're, you know, a hostage to only be able to get pregnant without, only being able to get pregnant through this means.
Wait, so, this is the patient or the agent of the IVF?
This is the patient who is undergoing surgery, who has her fallopian tubes removed with the explicit intent of trying to improve the success that she will have, as you know, be able to carry a child to term with IVF. And right. Many times without her knowledge in advance that this would be done, it's just presumed that someone would choose this. I want to back up a little bit. A thought came to mind. I wanted to share a little bit of background. When I was in medical school, and this relates to how little awareness there is that anyone has a problem with IVF. There was an ethics class that we were talking about, and it's what you would expect, a very kind of secularized version of medical ethics. And the faculty member in the class presented on the chalkboard the ethical dilemma of certain IVF clinics run perhaps by evangelical Protestants that would not perform this procedure for unmarried couples or, you know, two women, you know, that were in a same-sex relationship requesting this. And he was listing the numbers of issues, and I raised my hand and said, IVF itself, you know, is an ethical issue we need to talk about. And the response from my classmates was laughter. And that just, you know, brings to bear how much ignorance this was. It was something it was laughable that this would even be brought up. And many of my classmates would identify as Catholic. And so if someone was talking about ethical issues regarding abortion and someone said, we need to talk about whether or not abortion is ethical, there wouldn't be laughter. There's at least an acknowledgement that Catholics, you know, and other Christians have an objection to child murder. But with IVF, that's just a reminder of how evil it is. And, you know, I know we're going a little bit, you know, out of order, but I did, before we go too far into this, Tim, want to, you know, early on here, just make two points, lest other people, you know, get the wrong impression, that I'm very much aware, and I know you are as well, that most patients who go into this don't know what they're doing. It's like our Lord in the cross, you know, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do. So as we go through just this, you know, litany of moral evils, it's important to understand that only God knows someone's heart. I can't judge anyone, including the many of the IVF practitioners. They, to some degree, you know, may not know. I think they have much higher culpability. They are more intimately familiar with these issues than I am. They've hardened their conscience typically. But I'm speaking more to the patients that are desperate, that are suffering from infertility, that are many times referred to the IVF centers by other doctors that are non-IVF doctors that are very ignorant of this list of evils. And then one related point I think we need to just put out at the very beginning is that the children that are conceived by IVF, the children, the young adults, the adults that are alive today as a result, you know, they have a dignity every bit as much as you and I. You know, the means by which they were conceived has no bearing on their legitimacy as human beings. And that's why this matters to us. You know, just like the child that would be most likely targeted for abortion that was born out of wedlock to a teen mother. So in no way are we denigrating the existence of these children. But we can, you know, talk about the evil means by which they were conceived without disparaging, you know, their human dignity.
Yeah, Steph always tells people that when the abortion issue comes up, she's the child of teen parents. And like Steve Martin in The Jerk, she says, you, sir, are talking to a bastard. So you know, it's a, of course, this is not a dignitarian issue on the part of the child. Actually, it is really, because what they were subject to even be born is inhumane. But of course, there's no question that the dignity of the kid is intact. Look, before we get into your list a little bit further, I want to say this. People, parish orphans and retrogrades out there, you need to contextualize properly what's going on in this country. The biggest moral issue that this country has ever been beset by, far bigger than slavery or segregation, is abortion and all of its indicia, all of its progeny, all of its outcroppings, conceptually and morally speaking. And IVF is one that's, this might not be the sexiest topic, but it's important because I have known, when I taught at Catholic school, good people that were on the up and up trying to improve their practice of Roman Catholicism that would tiptoe around me and a couple of the other theology teachers there that they knew were Orthodox. And so as much as they tiptoed around us, I'm thinking of a couple people came to us and said, you know, my relative is pregnant, you know, praise be God, by IVF. They didn't even know to tiptoe around us on this issue. So there's a, like you say, heaven help them. They know not what they do. That's why we're covering IVF today, because it's at least adultery, conception, abortion, cloning, masturbation, pornography, usually sterilization. And that's the context. We're waiting for the holding in Dobbs, which is due next month. And everything's going to change. And I think the country, we're going to find that we have no union. We had no union between red and blue states. But that's the backdrop here. And of course, the backdrop to the backdrop is what I've been telling people for 3 years. Go to realestateforlife.org. If you're in a blue state, get out of your blue state. Get to a red state. Realestateforlife.org will help you folks to do that. Final plug here. We have now, because what gave us Roe versus Wade, what gave us ubiquitous abortion on demand, feminism, Steph's book, Ask Your Husband, is back for sale. If you go to timothyjgordon.com, go to publications, I think it's on the first page anyway, you could get for a mere $30 the second edition of her book, beautiful new cover, some new research, more extensive research and writing. And you want to
I signed it.
Yeah, of course. That's the main draw. We're selling this thing for either $30 hardback or in the trade paperback, $30 for a signed copy. Go to timothyjgordon.com. And that's the best way at this point to support this program is to buy the books or to go to patreon.com, Timothy J. Gordon. Signed copies of the books, which will get to you by mail sometime in June. You can purchase for pre-order now that autographed copy of Steph's book. Okay, so let's go back to Dr. Damon Cudahy. What do you have for us? Make this case to people that are out there still scratching their heads.
Well, I'm going to come back to the list because I think going back to origins is important as well. And when I am digging into this, it's really shocking what we learn about the beginnings of IVF and who actually invented it and why it was invented in the process. And so we go back to this zoologist named Robert Edwards in England, who later received the Nobel laureate for developing this. He had a partner who was an abortionist, actually, a guy named Patrick Steptoe. So he was funding his IVF research in the early 70s by doing abortions, sometimes late-term abortions on the side. You know, interestingly and relatedly, he was also an innovator in new types of sterilization using the laparoscope. So a lot of laparoscopic procedures today to sterilize women were invented by, you know, and perfected, you know, in a sense, by this co-inventor of the IVF procedure. So, you know, again, this shouldn't surprise us, you know, that you have that kind of moral, you know, hardened, you know, or that kind of moral compromised person involved in this. And there's a connection to even a, you know, a mockery of the Catholic faith too. And there is a quote, and I think it was a New York Times interview not that long ago by the Robert Edwards, where he says, and I'll quote here, I wanted to find out exactly who was in charge, whether it was God himself or whether it was scientists in the laboratory. It was us, he says. The Pope looked totally stupid.
Wow.
Yeah, you can never ban anything. You can, this is still quoting this, the IVF inventor. You can quote, you can say, hang on a minute, but never say never, and never say that this is the worst decision for mankind. Otherwise, you can look a fool. And listen to this last part of the quote. Now, there are as many Roman Catholics coming for treatment as Protestants. So he's mocking us. He's mocking the Catholic Church that, you know, among the women and couples that are coming to him for IVF, that there's no distinction between Catholics and Protestants. I think we see that. And other things like sterilization and even abortion, where this has been going on. But so the beginning of IVF, the first child that survived the process was named Lewis Brown and born in 1978. And then, you know, the church, you know, pretty soon after, and John and Vitae, by then Cardinal Ratzinger of the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, put out this document clarifying, you know, why this was, unacceptable. So just with that background, where to start, let me get back to this list. So we talked about exploitation of young women, sterilization. Now, I don't know if it's always done, but I would say it's frequently done in the process. And so how is the sperm obtained? And it theoretically could be obtained in a more illicit manner, but it's not. I've never heard of an IVF procedure done and one of these potentially morally illicit means of procurement. The way it's normally done.
Sure. Technically speaking, it could be procured without getting into the logistics too much. Technically speaking, it could be procured without, I guess, pornography.
Right.
Given the imaginative powers of the agent.
But
mean, it couldn't be procured fully licitly, right? Because it's got to be.
Well, I mean, so there is so going back to Dr. Hilger's, you know, there's theologians that looked at this using a perforated condom type device. So in a normal act of intercourse, that it's not purely contraceptive with even some perforations, some of the sperm could get through the latex barrier and you could still collect the majority of the sperm within the normal marital act. So that's how it could be theoretically procured. And so that's how pro-life Catholic physicians like myself, if we do find a need to obtain perform a semen analysis, that's how it would be collected. So it would be done in a way that's not degrading to the husband or the marriage or the marital act. So that's but people that are going to that extreme, you know, are not involved in IVF. So masturbation is the ordinary and almost the exclusive means of collection. And then pornography is typically distributed as one IVF technician said, as they call them, aids, you know, to help men, you know, if they, you know, don't have enough imagination. So it's a normal part of the process. And then the next thing I put on there that I alluded to before is material adultery. So when your wife is getting pregnant from the sperm of another man, it may not be physical full adultery, but if his sperm is put into her body through artificial insemination, which is a spinoff of this issue, but even in a petri dish and she's bearing another child, there's a certain sense in which that would be a material adultery, or it could be the other way around with another woman's egg. And so that's, again, a part of third party reproduction. But this is an important one. Number seven on my list is a commodification of children. Now children have become products to be manufactured, purchased, and in a sense, kind of sold. I'll never forget, we were taking a family road trip when I was finishing my residency training up north. We were driving down 75 to my wife's family. And I saw this, you know, what at first glance was a beautiful picture of a child on a billboard. It looked like one of these Choose Life pictures with a newborn baby smiling. But this was very different. This billboard, it had a message across it that said, "Want one?" With a question mark. It was an advertisement for an IVF clinic. And that just really kind of just solidified in my mind what was going on. We're selling babies as a commodity now. And young, you know, children that grow up in a family, oftentimes a single, you know, a single child, maybe two, or if they had twins, they experience that. And there's a whole movement of these children. There's a website called thembeforeus.com, I believe it is. They profile a lot of these stories of just the psychological suffering and existential suffering, knowing that they have siblings that, you know, never made it, that they don't know about. So again, number seven, the commodification of children. Number eight, the financial exploitation of women and men. people aren't aware of how expensive this is, it typically takes more than two cycles. So on average, about three cycles. Each cycle is going to be about $20,000 or more. A lot of that's for the medications. You know, you have a lot of couples that both parents are working. They take out a second mortgage on their house, literally spend all their life savings, go into debt, you know, $100,000 many times by the time they actually get pregnant with a child that's going to make it to viability, to live outside the womb. So there's that aspect of it. And I said financial exploitation is also an emotional and a spiritual exploitation of women. Most people don't intuitively want to go through this sort of bypassing of the natural act of intercourse. They're desperate. They're suffering from the deprivation of a good, which is fertility. And so they're emotionally vulnerable. And so you have this industry that's exploiting them. And it's not too far off from the way that a typical abortion clinic exploits the suffering or the fear of women unexpectedly pregnant, you know, in a situation where they don't feel they're prepared to raise a child, which goes into the next thing. So item number nine, pre-implantation diagnosis. So this is a type of eugenic selection, where you now have all the embryos in the petri dish, and you've already gone through this process of grading, where they've looked under the microscope and they've assigned them a grade like they do eggs or meat. It's typically a letter, or rather a number, and then two letters. You might have like three B, C, something like that. And the ones that are graded in terms of quality by the way they look under the microscope are typically discarded, literally thrown in the trash. That's their language. They throw these human beings in the trash if they're deemed to be of inferior quality. They think they may not survive the process.
Let me stop you there. We're talking about fertilized eggs now.
We're talking about human beings. Yeah,
human absolutely. Beings. We're talking about human beings qua fertilized eggs. A lot of folks out there, even knowledgeable Catholics, do not understand what you just said. So I just want to measure what we're saying here, that basically every IVF act involves abortion. Have there been IVF acts that don't involve the throwing out of fertilized eggs qua human beings?
I'm not aware of any. It's theoretically possible, but I doubt that it happens with any regularity, because as we spoke briefly about on the phone, it wouldn't be financially, you know, profitable for them to only fertilize one or two eggs, because there'd be such a low rate of success. And so these clinics advertise their success rate. So they want to do everything they can to maximize their success and a pure, you know, outcomes measure. And I'm glad you brought that up, Jim, because this is another thing where we need to be clear, you know, and a lot of the leftist, you know, secular media will hear things, and probably will continue to hear things like, you know, Catholics, you know, have this religious belief that life begins at conception. And when I speak about this, I try to make the point that we don't believe that life begins at conception, which we now need to clarify is synonymous with fertilization. I'll get into that later. We don't believe that because the church teaches it. We believe that because that is the scientific, you know, biologic consensus of our understanding of the origin of human life. And this
the church teaches it, in other words, because of the science. The church does not teach this as a doctrine of the faith. It teaches it as an article of natural biology and human life.
I would go further. I would say the church merely teaches that it's always and everywhere a universal truth and absolute truth. It's always and everywhere immoral and illicit, unacceptable, intrinsic evil to intentionally kill an innocent human being. So when those three criteria are met, when it's intentional, when the human person is innocent, and when it's a human person. And so all we are doing is applying our intelligence, our understanding of the science here, now that we know, and there's no dispute about the fact that this is a human being, that we are dealing now with a unique individual human person, a full complement of chromosomes. This is not the woman's body. This is not my body. It came together as a contribution from both of our bodies, but now we are scientifically speaking about a new person. This happens at the one cell stage. And so I've had patients that, you know, were Catholic that seemed to be a little bit confused about that, because like abortion, we want to kind of obfuscate the reality of what's going on. So women will be talked about as if these are just eggs, or they're just fertilized eggs, but kind of an emphasis on the egg, that we're not talking about embryos, and these are inferior quality eggs. And even though we're actually the scientific honest, you know, analysis is that these are not just eggs anymore. These are actually human beings now. Another, you know, kind of pro-life point, you know, in discussing this, you know, you or I were never a sperm cell or an egg cell. But once, you know, our parents, you know, the union of the egg and sperm, that's when our life began. And so this idea that, you know, when a that sperm dying is equivalent to abortion is preposterous, you know, that, you know, we've heard in, you know, some of these pro-abortion talking points. But yeah,
there's an analogy to be made here to help people flesh this out.
Yeah.
It is actually, according to Pius X, a condemnable heresy to allege that the belief in one God is an article of the faith. Did you know that? It's not. The belief in a single God is a proposition of natural reason, and it's wow, undeniable through the natural reason. Similarly, it hasn't been anathematized as a heresy, but similarly, this belief that you just pointed up, Dr. Damon, the belief that, you know, abortion is wrong, abortion is murder, abortion stops a beating human heart, has anything to do with religious doctrine, which is to say teaching, is absolutely, like unto a heresy, right? It's simply 46 chromosomes that are human. Small fertilized egg is human life. It's living and it's human. It's living and it's human. It is human life. It is a human being. This is a simple proposition of science, and the church teaches what it teaches about abortion simply because of this. This is not one of the articles of the faith like the hypostatic union or the doctrine of the
transubstantiation. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It should be evident. And this reminds me, I want to throw a shout out to the journalist, John Zmirak. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. He published an article recently in The Stream, and I quoted it, you know, and I put it on Twitter and some of my friends. He said, in an interview I heard with him yesterday with Jason Jones, he says that the evil of abortion is more certain than the existence of God. And that blows my mind. I mean, we don't want to believe that's true, but in the conversion story of Steve Mosher, if you know, for those of you who are familiar with his work with Population Research Institute, he discovered the one-child policy in China. He was an atheist at the time, but the horror of the forced abortion, the forced sterilization of these women in China actually eventually led him to God and seeing the evil of that. And when he came back to the United States, so you're right. This isn't an article of faith, and that's why we have many atheists and people of different faiths that can see this. It's not, you don't have to be Catholic to appreciate this, although it makes it a lot easier to, you know, understand the principles involved when we get into the double effect, things like that, and how that's a distinct matter. So
yeah, I'm friends with Zmirak. You can't get more certain than certain. And that would explode the analogy if true. And it was actually, it would be like a Pyrrhic victory if that were fully true, that the evils of abortion might equal the certainty, epistemically speaking, of the certainty of the existence of God. But of course,
right.
if God weren't as a matter of plain brute fact existent, then abortion wouldn't be evil. So I'd have to demur. Yeah. But it's at least as certain.
And I don't know if I entirely agree with that, but it's very thought provoking, and I can relate in my own deepening conversion as a college student. When I entered college, I had a much deeper conviction that abortion, that child murder, was evil than I did that the Catholic faith was the true faith. And it was actually, I was drawn deeper into the faith because of an awareness of how clear this was. And I saw the church as being the most consistent witness, you know, for these truths. So that there was a connection, but yeah, I see your point there. So pre-implantation diagnosis, which is similar to what happens with children conceived naturally in the womb, where we're doing genetic testing to determine primarily if they have Down syndrome. And then we're going to, you know, advise and oftentimes, you know, convince the woman to murder her child by abortion if her child has an increased possibility of Down syndrome. So this is, you know, just being brought to the level of Petri dish and the IVF laboratory. The next thing is unique to IVF, though. It's the cryopreservation of living human beings. And it's estimated that there's over 1 million of these human beings, of these children, that are in liquid nitrogen right now that are being frozen. And again, wow, as Catholics, we understand that the human body matters. Our bodies are important. And so, you know, taking a living human being, even at they're not one cell by this time, even if they're at the blastocyst, there may be 8, 32, you know, 64, you know, a bundle of cells is still a human being, a very early part of the of the child's development that they're frozen. And many of them actually don't survive the thawing process. For many times, this is a lethal procedure. When we freeze something, there's ice crystals and there's kind of a ripping and tearing of cellular structures. And so this is itself, you know, a violation of the respect we owe to other human beings and their bodies. And this is routinely done as an intermediary. Some patients don't feel comfortable with the idea of merely throwing the extra embryos in the trash, again, their word, trash can. So they feel a little better about just freezing them, kind of putting, you know, things on hold. And so you have these couples that might have 10 or more embryos in liquid nitrogen. And then they have this dilemma, what to do about it. That's a whole nother discussion, which, you know, what to do about these. But
What if they were to, even because these are the less viable, I don't want to call them samples, they're human beings, the less viable little humans with less of a shot that were deemed.
Well, actually, they're not. The ones that they're freezing are the ones that they think will survive. The less viable ones are immediately put in the trash.
Okay. So, is it
so they're trying
how
to take
is it possible on a hypothetical basis that somebody, not that I'm encouraging people to do this because there are nine other heresies involved by it, but how would somebody theoretically, hypothetically, you know, secure a baby by IVF without aborting any of them? Would they have to bring all of the samples to allow them?
First of all, they would have to only fertilize one or two eggs, you know, say two, because they want to maximize the chance. So if they had two eggs fertilized, two human embryos now, and they tried to implant both of them, that's really the only way you can reduce the evils down to merely being, you know, a violation of this principle of the essential need for both unity and openness to life in the marital act. So, but it's still evil there, but all the other evils kind of spin off of it. But that doesn't happen anywhere. The survival rate is so low in that situation. You would only, only about 4% of children ever survive this process. So it would never be financial. People aren't going to pay $20,000, you know, per cycle to go through a process that only has a 4% chance of one of these children living. And it would be, you know, just completely people couldn't afford it and the industry would go out of business. So that's, you know, theoretically, you may be able to find a way to procure the sperm in a more illicit way, but there are violations and harms to a woman's body in the process that also violate, you know, some issues of moral law. But even if you could theoretically, this is purely theoretically, that the success rate would be so exceedingly low that it would never, you know, be done, and it's not done anywhere that I'm aware of.
By the way, you just reminded me. The adultery entailed by an act of IVF is not only material, it's formal, right? Form being the principle of individuation, the principle of the act.
Oh, thank you.
The first act. Yeah. So the principle of the procreative act is, of course, the unitive end. And you're cutting right to the unitive end. That is the principle by which the act is intelligible. So we would say technically, if I'd have to think about this. Yeah,
I mean, it's just because there's not the physical, you know, adultery of another man having intercourse with someone who's not his wife, you know, that. So it's there is a distinction, but I don't know the best language to describe it. But it's a species, I think we could agree, of adultery.
Well, there's not genital contact, but there is contact. What I meant is the form, the intelligible act of the principle.
Yeah.
The principle which animates the act, which is the form, is the procreation, right? And so you have the intentional intermingling of the congenital material. That is that's more than it's material adultery to go to get my prostate checked, I think, or something like that. That's everyone's out there like, holy cow, man, I didn't tune in for this today. But that's material adultery.
I don't know if I can agree with that, but that's we'll come back to that. There's a lot we're going to talk about here.
Genital contact would be material. A material adultery is really to say, when we say something's a material instance of the formal, we're saying it's not the thing, right? Whereas this is actual adultery.
It's more than material, because there is, I see your point, and I don't think I would disagree with that. Well, there's another issue that I think that people don't think about. It's come up in our state, Louisiana, this idea of surrogacy. So surrogate motherhood, a woman being hired for her womb. And this is, I think the best way we can understand this thing that would only exist because of IVF it's another type of prostitution. And the traditional, the more typical way we think of prostitution, a woman's body is exploited for the pleasure of the marital act, where there's no intention of having a child. And this type of prostitution, a woman's body is exploited purely for her reproductive capacity and bearing new life. And so these women are typically paid, like prostitutes often are, and it's typically targeting poorer women and that are, you know, more vulnerable. And that's why there's this phenomenon of medical tourism, whether it's India or Eastern European, where women are paid to bear the children of these wealthy Europeans or Americans that don't want to, they can't physically or aren't interested in carrying their own children. And so this is something that, and you'll hear, you know, sometimes there may be a wife's sister that offers to be the surrogate mother. And I saw one exchange, I think it was shared on social media, where the husband, you know, not jokingly, tried to convince his wife, let's just bypass the whole IVF. Why don't I just have intercourse with her? And she was horrified at this. You know, she said, no, that would be so different. So it's going back to your point, Tim. You know, why would a woman, you know, be horrified at the idea of her husband sleeping with her sister, but not horrified with the idea of her sister bearing, you know, having his sperm put into her body, you know, and his child, you know, in her body. So, you know,
Sister works out more. That's why the wife is horrified. But they're not doing the Thomistic metaphysics requisite to understand that both are horrific.
But natural law comes through, you know, and the horror that the woman has, that it's more clear in that example.
Yeah.
So there's another. So I'm going back to the abortion thing now, because it's another reason that abortions are done. So item 12 on my list is there's this phenomenon of selective abortion of multiples, fetal reduction. And basically, this is where a woman, most commonly it's done in the setting of twins. And so to increase their success rates, it used to be done more. They don't try to transfer, you know, multiple embryos to the same degree they had done previously. In the earlier years of IVF, you saw many times, you know, quintuplets, six babies, seven babies, septuplets. And because these are very high risk pregnancies, these are very unnatural situations, that a lot of doctors decided that the solution was to basically kill all but one of them. And so it'd be a safer pregnancy. And so they call this selective reduction, and they would do genetic testing, make sure that we want a boy. Well, you've got two girls and a boy, we'll kill the two girls and we'll have a boy. And this is happening typically clearly after there's even a heartbeat, because one of the ways this is done is injecting a toxin, using potassium into the heart directly with the needle. So the people aren't aware that this isn't just done when you have septuplets or octuplets or things like that. This is most commonly done for twins. And that should blow your mind. When I'm sure, you know, I think you may have twins. We have many friends, I have many patients with twins. Twins aren't that uncommon. And it is a more difficult pregnancy, but most of my patients with twins go to term and have no, you know, adverse long-term issues, you know, with either child or the pregnancy. So, but the idea of this, again, it's just, we've opened the door. Once we've compromised in one area, it's so much easier, I think, to compromise in these other areas. And there's even this thought, because the women will say, well, because it was IVF, she was more, the whole thing seems to be artificial. So her moral objection to it is kind of weakened, and she's we've opened the door to this. And so now, you know, using another man's sperm, having aborting a few, throwing a few in the trash, this is all more tempting when you've already been compromised at the onset. Tim, I think you'll appreciate this one. 13 was destruction of the extra or inferior embryos, this grading system. I'm going to the legal one after that. I want to say on this is, IVF clinics are the factories producing embryos for embryo destructive research. These are the factories where they have the so-called spare or extra embryos. And so when they do the grading and they think these are higher quality embryos, these are the ones that are going to be sent off to the drug companies or sold to the drug companies that, you know, that are trying to look for this raw material. So we wouldn't have that abundant a source of raw material if it weren't for IVF. And yeah, the embryo destructive research is a whole nother show in itself. This is one I think you'll appreciate. There is now a legal precedent and case, you know, case law now, of these embryos being treated as property. And this has, you know, been decided already in the courts and in several instances where you have a situation where a married couple, typically Hollywood couples, the very wealthy that are much more likely to go, be able to afford the IVF. And, you know, their divorce rates 95% or so. It's not unexpected that these, you know, Hollywood couples divorce. Now they have, you know, a freezer, you know, and liquid nitrogen of embryos. And, you know, one of them gets the car, one of them gets the boat, one gets the house, who gets the embryos? You know, they're not, you know, treated as human beings like we treat other divorces when children are involved. They're now treated as property. And so it's something that we need to really think about and consider how we have literally gone back and regressed to a situation where an entire class of human beings are now again being treated like property.
Let me ask you a question, Dr. Damon. Best guess this for me. What portion of your colleagues, other OBGYNs, or even if we expand it out a little bit, MDs in general, are horrified by the brute facts which are received by an audience of non-doctors as mostly new, novel, yeah, or at least more profound than they've ever conceived of the proposition, but are not new or horrifyingly new to the doctors? They know all this stuff. What percentage of them agree that it's horrific with their up-close view of IVF?
So of doctors, of my colleagues, and I'll make a caveat, of my colleagues that are not as well formed in the faith and understanding of these matters, my honest assessment is probably less than 1% of doctors are horrified. So if I can do nothing else, and I gave a presentation of this at a diocese, you know, pro-life series last night, if we can do nothing else, but we need to increase, you know, the horror of this. We need to educate others, bring awareness, to use that politically correct, that buzzword. We need to bring awareness to the horror of this. We need to have a hatred for this evil, not the children involved, not even the parents that fall into it, but the evil principles involved. We need to hate this, and we need to, you know, have, you know, an understanding of why this is wrong. And so, you know, because there are many of my colleagues, other OBGYNs, you know, pretty much all of them, except for the other Catholics. And it tends to be only other Catholics, OBGYNs like myself, that are contraception free, that don't do sterilizations, direct sterilizations, or prescribe contraception for contraceptive purposes. Those are the only ones that I think would understand this and appreciate this. And, you know, there's a, you know, a kind of loose network of those around the country that are like-minded, but locally here, you know, I'm pretty much on an island as far as active practicing OBGYNs that don't refer patients. So you have, what I want to get to is, you have other OBGYNs that will see patients that are Catholic. This is a very Catholic area in Lafayette, Louisiana, that would never think of going to an abortion center, abortion clinic. Other OBGYN doctors that would be horrified at the idea of referring a patient to an abortionist because they're pregnant with their third child and, you know, they conceive their child outside of marriage. But they think nothing of referring these patients to IVF clinics. In fact, it's reflexive. They do very little, many times because they don't know what else to do to be able to better assess and diagnose and correct the problems causing fertility. It's very easy just to make a referral to the local IVF clinic. And so women are being very quickly referred, and there's this sort of thinking that, well, this doctor, I see her or I see him at Mass, and so if they're referring me to the IVF center, it must not be that bad. And the IVF clinics will often promote themselves as being centers of diagnosing and treating infertility, but the reality is they have a one solution, and it's IVF for everything. So they're doing very little, if anything, to actually try to identify the underlying cause of infertility and correcting that so that they can conceive by natural means.
Interrogate for a moment how that claim, less than 1% of fellow doctors would be horrified by this, how that comports with the proposition that IVF's moral terror is an article of natural biology. That doesn't come out so well for your colleagues, right? I mean, that's
true.
They shouldn't have to be Catholic, because this is, as you said at the beginning, this is not a proposition of Catholic moral theology. This is a proposition of natural biology, and they know enough to know better.
I think there's a degree of intellectual dishonesty. We don't want to even think about it. You know, if we start to suspect, we don't think enough about it. You know, some pro-life, you know, commentators, you know, will say, it's like that with abortion. you don't have to think more than 2 minutes to see how obviously evil this is. But when we use euphemisms and when we kind of close our minds to any thought of this. So, you know, when I get to that 1% of my colleagues who aren't horrified of it, I think it's not so much they're not horrified because they know the stuff I'm talking about and don't care. I think it's they don't want to know. They don't bother to look into it. They aren't willing to do the study of it. And many of them haven't been taught. They haven't heard. They've never heard, you know, if they're Catholic, they never heard a priest talk about it, you know, in any kind of catechetical setting or even on a homily. I have actually heard one or two homilies in my life, a good priest where this came up. But it's there's just a, you know, our people die for lack of knowledge in a sense here.
Yeah. Yeah. This is horrible stuff, but in a sense it's really good stuff. I don't know any other Catholic YouTube channel that's had this granular a look at what IVF.
I don't either.
So we've got adultery, so contraception, yeah. Abortion, to some extent it's analogable to cloning, masturbation, yep. Pornography, often sterilization. It's got an analogy to slavery here insofar as it's a commodifiable
property.
This is
prostitution. Prostitution.
Yeah. If you do the surrogacy. Isn't surrogacy to some extent, Dr. Damon, the opposite of IVF? I mean, it's the inverse of IVF.
I would say surrogacy is the inverse of the typical prostitution scenario, you know, whereas IVF is the inverse of contraception. With contraception, you know, Janet Smith, you know, famously described, this Catholic principle of the marital act designed by God to be both procreative and unitive. She described it as it's both for babies and bonding. And so with contraception, we're trying to engage in the marital act by avoiding procreation, whereas IVF, we're trying to procreate while avoiding the marital act by avoiding physical contact. So right. We're trying to have bonding without babies, and the latter, we're trying to have babies without bonding.
So morally speaking, absolutely, it's a great point. But like the relationship between IVF and surrogacy is an inverse correlation, right? In a typical IVF, you're implanting the fertilized zygote into the actual the guy's wife, let's say, husband and a wife.
Right.
So you don't need a surrogate. What's the situation logistically? I mean, biologically, logistically, with the surrogate. That's where you're borrowing the body like a prostitute of a non-wife, a third party, to implant the IVF, which is actually 23 chromosomes from each of the married parents?
Sometimes, not even. It may actually be, and it many times is, you know, a total complement of 46 chromosomes from two parents that no one even knows. They're anonymous. They call them donors. They're really vendors. They don't do this very frequently. From two anonymous so-called donors that have, you know, a college guy here, a college, you know, girl, that part of the country. You wouldn't even know who the parents are. And then they hire a third person. So you have this incredible, bizarre situation where the woman carrying the child is not legally going to be the mother. And this kind of, it varies on the state. I imagine how the states rule and recognize surrogacy contracts, but where the mother would not only doesn't have her own child in the womb, it's actually not even always the child of the married couple or not married, the couple who hired her to carry this child. So again, we're sort of, you know, parsing out, you know, who is the father, who is the mother, who is actually they call them gestational carriers, kind of like a birthing person. But it's dehumanizing. It's degrading to the woman who's hired as a surrogate because she is not treated as a mother. She's treated as, and when I've, you know, worked with in my training, these women, you know, the language they use to describe what they're doing, I'm talking about the gestational surrogates. They said, this is a profession. I'm a professional.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm a professional. This is my profession. I do this for money. I mean, that's, you know, the typical justification for
oldest,
you know,
profession in the world, man.
There you go. There you go. This is a new age, a modernist version of it. Essentially.
Yeah. This is striking. I mean, it's striking to me and you know, I processed the points we were talking about the other night and it all makes sense, but the amount, the ubiquity of the phenomenon is striking in itself, because everyone knows an IVF couple. Most of us know, therefore, an IVF baby or two. And
it's becoming now, the latest statistics they're saying is 2 out of 100, so 1 out of 50, which is always going up because it's becoming more mainstream. You know, there are some insurance companies that are paying for it. Most don't, thank God. So at least you have the financial burden, a little bit of a deterrent, but we need more than a financial burden to be a deterrent. We need there to be a moral conviction and catechesis, at least within the Catholic Church, because like the inventor said, Catholics are going to the IVF clinics as much as non-Catholics.
Well, okay, so let's expand out a little bit further. This sure. is a subset of Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health and Roe v. Wade. Let's just, in closing, I want to give you a parting shot here because you do have an extra clinically valid point of view, especially materially insightful. You are an OBGYN. Assuming that Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health comes out the way that it was leaked it would be.
Right.
What can you say? You're in, well, I won't say what state you're in, but you're in a state where I think it's one of the trigger states.
It is. Yeah.
What are the folks saying, by the folks, and I mean the other OBGYNs in your state, about the implications of being in a trigger state and having Roe versus Wade forcibly overturned, whatever the leftists are saying? Are they mad? Are they glad?
They're not. Actually, one of my call partners, who, you know, does prescribe contraception, you know, wouldn't have any objection to IVF. But I think here where I'm at, most of my colleagues actually do abhor abortion. So one of them texted me the other day when this news came out and said, "This is great. We're finally going to end abortion in Louisiana." So we do have a trigger law. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, then abortion, you know, the majority of them will likely be illegal here. But I sent you, if you saw it, an article this morning. I was searching already now. There's a CNN article. The IVF industry is a little bit scared now. There's articles popping up and the press about people are fearing that we're going to be coming after their IVF clinics, or that we're going to be coming after intrauterine devices, which cause abortions, or birth control pills, which many times cause abortions. Whole nother talk. But so I think that, but the IVF, you know, industry is, I don't think it would exist if we had a healthier consistency with recognizing the dignity of the human person, they're deserving of equal treatment under the law and protection. If we recognize that from the moment of their existence at fertilization, i.e. conception, then IVF would have never been allowed to begin with. So I think that, you know, we're a long ways from ending IVF, but it's interesting to see that there is already some alarmism about that in the industry. I don't see IVF ending in the near future. But, you know, I didn't expect to see Roe v. Wade overturned in my lifetime either. But you know, God, you know, sometimes you know, exceeds, will surprise us in these kind of matters.
Yeah, that's what's most interesting about the way that the black letter law, it's not actually black letter law, it's judicial review, it's judge made law, is going to come out. The way that this opinion is written next month, the way that we get to see it finalized as not just a draft, but an express opinion of the high court, matters very much for progeny, for related conceptual topics like IVF, for related conceptual topics like whether or not this, 3357 SB, whether or not that will circumvent whatever ostensibly comes out in the Dobbs opinion. It depends on the language of the opinion itself. So there are tons and tons and tons of questions which remain when you quote unquote overturn Roe versus Wade. There's going to be so much work done at the level of federal courts that needs to be done. Hopefully this thing is interpreted as broadly as it sounded like Alito was writing the opinion to express. You know, a broad repudiation of quote unquote abortion rights.
Well, let me say just a little bit of inside baseball here. So I've been involved in our state legislature, and I'll say it, it's Louisiana, a neighboring red state. Yeah. And I've been at the health and welfare committee hearings testifying in favor of other pro-life legislation that we've been able to advance, including a previous Supreme Court challenge, and I was hired to be an expert witness and defending some of this pro-life legislation, putting more restrictions on abortion centers. But whenever we tried to pass a law banning these gestational surrogacy contracts in the state, and what we found is that while we could have a majority of state legislators that are with us and the pro-life matters and everything else, you know, trigger laws with abortion, you know, having abortionists held the same standards in terms of admitting privileges, wait lists, all of it. But when it came to IVF, we lost 90% of our support. Yeah. And so we're back down to almost on 1% of people that, although they will reject abortion and willing to vote in favor of laws restricting it or ending it, they don't want to touch IVF. And part of the reason is because they know someone, one of their colleagues, when this came up, they passed out pictures to all the legislators of their child that was conceived by IVF. And so they try to make it personal and appeal to emotions rather than the principles. So that's part of the battle we have. That's why I can't thank you enough, Tim, for having me on, because this is an issue that we need to be talking about more. I'm so glad that we're talking about abortion more. This is the first time in my lifetime, I think, there's ever been much of a public discussion of the matter, but I think we need to bring this into the discussion as well.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on. This was great. Do you have any, in closing here, Dr. Damon, do you have any call numbers or websites you want to direct people to?
Sure. My website is simply acadianaobgyn.com. I just got back on Twitter a couple of weeks ago after I heard that Musk would buy it. My Twitter handle is at D Cudahy, my first initial last name. Probably the best place, especially for a patient, I try to put some resources on the website, is it's acadianaobgyn .com. So, and if you look at my name.
Yeah, text me that and I'll put it in the show notes.
So people,
everyone out there, Parasovans Retrogrades, go check the show notes if you're interested in visiting Dr. Damon's website. That was great. That presentation is extremely compelling. And I thank you for your time. Maybe I'll have you back on the show after Dobbs is released in June.
Sure. I'd enjoy it. I appreciate it.
Thanks a million. Parasovans and Retrogrades.
Thank you,
Tim. Yeah, God bless you guys. Everyone stay strong. Hold fast for this opinion. Fast and pray. And we'll see what happens next month. Abortion needs to be eliminated one way or another. Amen. So be it. Yeah. Everyone else out there, in closing, go buy Steph's book on timothyjgordon.com. Now available for pre-order. You can get an autographed copy. Go to publications. Deus vult. God bless you all.
Deus vult.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.